So good morning. I'm Greg. Listen, thanks so much for coming first thing in the morning. I seem to have this thing about 8:15 a.m. sessions, Tech Ed. So, but fortunately, this one wasn't the day after the party, so that's it's a little bit better than usual. Yeah, it's usually Friday morning or something when we follow that directly on. So look, anyway, so where I fit in, I'm part of SQL Down Under, and basically, I suppose, a SQL Server junkie for a very long time. Well, at least since the days it was on floppies, which is usually a fairly good indication of the age of that. So the nice thing about that is that with the rate the platform expands, at least I don't feel like I have to sort of learn the whole thing in a hurry, so you get sort of to trickle feed it over a long period of time. Also involved heavily with Parse and do some writing. And in the case of Parse, if you do get a chance to go to a SQL Server targeted conference later in the year, that I highly recommend getting along and trying to get to that one. How many people have been to the Parse Summit? So, a few, okay. So, and good value? Yeah, it's amazing. It's typically a week long, and there are about over 200 SQL sessions on offer. And so, and there's usually about 4,000 people there, so I'll give you a sort of feel for the level of the SQL event. It's very significant. But I'm very pleased to see you all here today. And so look, what this is covering off, I wanted to address first up a whole lot of issues around Windows Azure SQL Database, or what we used to call SQL Azure, where people seem to have misconceptions about what this does and doesn't do. And just wanted to be very clear about what it does and doesn't do, and have a look also at things that you need to do when integrating your applications to work in this platform. I'm going to give you a few minutes having a look at scaling out, and in particular lead into federations. But Chris Auld has a session on Friday morning that's a deep dive on SQL Azure Federations, and I'd encourage you to get along to that session to find out more about that. But I'll show you the core parts of that first up. I'll mention about DataSync, which is still in preview at present, but just want to give you a feel for what that can and can't be used for. And finally, the latest one here is SQL Reporting, which has now become available in recent times, and give you again a feel for what is included in that at the moment and what it's targeted at and the sort of places you can use that. So dealing with the questions I get all the time, first up, I get this question that says, isn't this just some sort of hosted SQL database? And it's not like that. The thing you have to be thinking about is that we're talking about having SQL as a service. And so instead of you getting all involved in the provision of various things, it really is more a case of trying to think of literally a service where I have an endpoint, it talks TDS protocol, we jam SQL statements into it, and it does SQL stuff, you know. But the back end of how that happens increasingly should be sort of opaque to you. It shouldn't be a big issue. And the aim is to allow you to focus much more on the sort of the logical design of what you're doing and being able to hook up SQL services to achieve outcomes rather than spending your time worrying about how to physically implement that. It's a very big cluster in place, but a very important point is it's based on commodity hardware. Now, this is something that people, again, seem to have trouble wrapping their head around. I get the idea. People seem to think it's some sort of like supercomputing things in place and so on. That's not the case. Right? So what we're talking about is a very, very big cluster of commodity hardware. So not even bleeding edge hardware, but hardware at a point where the price performance point is sufficient that they can then sort of build structures over the top of that. Now, that brings some of the limitations that we'll talk about down the track, but it also brings a lot of benefits in scalability and cost, right, in being able to do that. And as I said, it's more a focus at the upper levels rather than physical. I also get asked, people say, look, is my data secure, right? There's this sort of feeling like if I don't have my data sitting on that old machine under my desk, that somehow this is something I can't have confidence in. But look, the thing I say to people here is, look, the people looking after this stuff on their worst day are going to do a better job than you do. right? I mean, be honest, right? I mean, that's all they're doing, right? I mean, if you look at the level of what they're achieving here, this is well beyond. Like, I spend my life doing consulting work. I go into companies, you know what I mean? And I see what happens. And I have to tell you that when I have walked into one of their data centers, the feel is completely different. You know, there is no comparison. And so it's very good from that point of view. Look, firewall, there is a firewall in place. I'll show you how that's configured in a minute and where that sits. But for applications where you don't know where people are coming from, then that's of limited use, I think, because it only allows you to do IP restrictions. But if you have a mobile workforce, then that might not be an issue for you. But if you have people coming from fixed addresses, like a particular fixed address for your company, working with a proxy or something, and everybody goes through that, absolutely, you can sort of tie it down to those specific addresses. It does require SSL, and so there is an overhead in having SSL in place, but again, they don't want to have issues where somebody could look at the traffic along the way. They have detailed denial of service gear built in. Now, again, most people who implement this thing, these things themselves don't do this, right? And so that's nice. Encryption is the one that a lot of people say, hey, that isn't there yet. Now, that's true. There isn't transparent database encryption yet. There's still nothing to stop you encrypting your data before you put it in the database. And so that works just fine. But transparent database encryption is obviously on the list of things that no doubt they'll target down the track. But it's also one, how many people are using that? Only a couple. Okay. Now, it is one that I hear people mention a lot, and it makes me nervous, right? And the reason I say that is that if you haven't been, I've been to like a lot of, say, SharePoint sessions, and they say, you should protect your data, you should encrypt the database. And then they show you how to turn it on, and then that's the end of the discussion, right? That's a formula for a big problem, right? And so one of the things I've been doing over the last few years is teaching a master's class in Redmond for Microsoft. And most of the people in the room are senior product support engineers and people like that from the SQL Server team. One of the things I used to do for entertainment is to try and get them to set mirroring up on an encrypted database. Now, the problem wasn't getting mirroring working, right? The problem is they couldn't work out how to restore an encrypted database on another server. Right? This is the challenge. So if you turn that on without knowing the whole life cycle, I think the best acronym I've heard for this is a CLM. This is a career limiting move, right? Don't do that, right? So TDE is a very, very good thing, but only if you've worked through the entire life cycle and you know how to deal with it, right? Otherwise, I'd tread carefully. All right, so another one is availability. And it is built in, a large degree of this. Now, one of the things I like about this is that they immediately have three copies of your data. So there's three replicas in place. Again, if I look at the number of sites I go into on a daily basis where people would have three online replicas, you know, you're talking about almost no sites, you know, whatsoever around the country. So this is well above what most people do. The way they do their reads, it does come off the primary, but the writes are always a quorum. So unless there are two writes occurred, then they don't return from your write. Now, clearly, that has an impact, again, in terms of performance, but it's a decision they've made in terms of high availability. It also allows them to do fairly instantaneous failover, and also when they're doing upgrades, they can do rolling upgrades through the product. So you're far less impacted if they do upgrades. And in fact, they tend to do upgrades very much, pretty much on a quarterly basis, seems to be as the features get rolled out at present. And very few people would even know that's happening most of the time. Do I get my own server? Well, no, right? So what you get is you get yourself a subscription, and from that you can build or assign logical servers. But it's important to understand that the server is a logical concept. That's all it is. It is possible to programmatically provision these as well. And so this is a thing that's very interesting. I used to see people having large amounts of UAT and tests and so on and staging infrastructure. And increasingly, I'm seeing people now who, as part of a build process, are going spinning up the virtual machines, doing the testing and so on, and then just spinning down all the hardware again at the other end. And this is a significant change for how people build. And the difference in capital expenditure, you couldn't overestimate what that is. The master database is kind of curious. You get one of those, but it's a very logical concept that's more there for backwards compatibility. That's really, you'll find that there's next to nothing in it. And then the databases that you get on that server, the thing to wrap your head around is that they're not probably on the same server. In fact, it's very likely they're not. And they're typically spread across multiple racks. So if I have three databases on the server, they'll probably end up with three copies of those on different physical racks around a data center. And so you're talking about something very distributed. And this is why the focus is completely on databases, not on the concept of dealing with a server. And because you can't just go from one database straight to another one with a use statement, that database probably isn't on the same server. They also give you access to look and configure the firewall rules programmatically as well. Now, in terms of size, this is another one. People talk about, you hear all these things when it first appeared, they talk about infinite scale and so on, and then people looked and the biggest databases were 10 gig, and they went, like, well, what does that mean, right? Now, that's changed over time. There are two editions of this. There are currently a web edition and a business edition. The business edition is now up to 150 in terms of size. Now, most sites I go into today, even large sites, tend to have one or two very large databases, but then typically every other database in the place I see could fit, you know, in that sort of size. What you want to think about the additions is they're more an upper limit on the growth. So if you configure it as a web edition, it's going to limit the growth to 5 gig. Whereas if you set it as a business edition, it's going to allow it to grow beyond that. And mostly that's just around maintaining and limiting potential pricing. The pricing does encourage multi-tenant applications. Now, that may change, again, over time. But what this means is that the bigger the database gets, the cheaper it gets, right? So it's very much how it's laid out. As I said, can be on different physical servers. Now, I just want to show you a quick look at the management portal and database designs and so on, now and the tools. Now, the interesting thing with this is that whenever I'm preparing a session, I always sort of get really nervous about anything that involves connectivity. And I have many of my colleagues think I'm paranoid because I record videos of what I was going to show you. And this morning, when I checked the service status, there are intermittent portal issues on the thing. So look, this is shown on the page. And so I have had a look. The issue is, a couple of the issues are things I do wish to show you. And so in that case, I'm finally going to go with a smug smile and go, I knew there was a reason I built all those videos. Right, so let me show you this. So from the main entrance page at the sort of Windows Azure, let's push this up. I log onto the portal. This is a live account that I'm using in this case. And so nothing terribly surprising there. It's like magic typing. Yeah, it's good. Now, once this comes up, what we've got down the left-hand side here are the services that I have access to at present. So I've got a number of hosted servers. In particular, I'm using a storage account there. I've got database services. Data sync, as I said, is still in preview and reporting. And so if I look into the database, you'll see I've got two subscriptions sitting there at present. And in those subscriptions, this is where you can drill down and look at the logical servers that have been configured. And so note the name, well, you know, it's not the most memorable thing. They allowed you to pick the names at first, but then people were picking Coca-Cola and Pepsi, and they stopped that. And so on the server, I've got a couple of databases. So notice there's a master, and I've got a user database there. But as I said, the master isn't terribly significant in terms of what's there. Now, the firewall rules, I've got two rules, one that says everything can come in, and then I've got another rule that says Microsoft services, which means other services on the Azure system, are able to access it. But that could be much tighter. Note the properties off to the right there, and in particular, they've got a fully qualified DNS name, and that's the one that I need to connect to, down under there. And at the bottom, you'll notice there's a manage URL, and this is the one down the bottom there is the URL you need to go to the management portal for that particular server. So if I click on the database and click manage, this sort of pushes me into the thing that's the part of the portal that allows me to deal with specifically with one database. And log on. And you see when we get into this, it's a very database-specific view that we're seeing in here. Now, these tools have been improving constantly. There is a preview portal as well for a brand new portal, but I'm showing you the one that's currently in use because it has more functionality still at the moment. Now, from this, I can go and start looking at the design of the database. And so I've clicked down the bottom on design. This is showing me the tables that are in place with row counts and sizes. The tables do have some limitations in terms of the design of the tables. If we look at the layout of this, for example, you must have a clustered index. It's probably the biggest thing straight up. So layouts there. You can also see indexes and keys. And so I've got, in this case, one primary key, which is clustered in that case. And I've got, in addition, one non-clustered index on that table. And we can also use this to drill in and look at the data directly. Now, they've also built a query interface in this. And this has improved over the last few versions. And so in here, I've opened up just a short script. And back to at least all the color coding and everything works correctly now, but they've just added execution plans recently. So I say, look, give me an actual plan that'll execute the query. It's returned the results, but it's also returned a query plan tab. And so if I look at the query plan tab, this is actually quite a nice view of the query plans now compared to what we have typically in SQL Server. That's showing the total of CPU and I/O, but you can also individually change the percentages to look at the effect of CPU and the effect of I/O in each of the operators. And often what people are looking for is finding things that are of interest. And so anything that has a warning, there's a way of searching for those. And more commonly, people are looking for things like table scans or a clustered index scan. And so if you click on that, notice it actually drags you across to the ones that have those table scans. If you click on this, it pops up the same sort of details that you typically see inside when we're working with query plans in Management Studio. And in addition to this, they've got a couple of other views of this, where you can see that same detail laid out in a grid. It's this one. And you can also see it sort of laid out in a tree view where it shows the structure of the operators involved. And so this has kind of improved quite a lot over the last few versions. There are limits on the size of the scripts that you can push up into that interface. And so at the moment, again, that magic number, the 64K number, never disappears in the industry, and it still has that limit on the size of the scripts. All right. And so another question comes up all the time is this going to fix my performance issues? And, well, probably not, right? So this, brutally honest. And so the thing about this, if I look at most performance, we do a lot of performance tuning work, and I would have to say probably 70% of that is application design, our application design issues. And so that nothing that they do there is going to fix that for you, right? And it's also not super high-end hardware, as we said. So that's not going to fix that. And so it's commodity hardware, it's a multi-tenant architecture, and you also have latency to concern yourself with as well, in particular when we're down in this part of the world. And so if you're looking to avoid performance issues, clearly you need to have built the database so that it works properly in the first place. I can't overstress sort of how much application design comes into this. I see people all the time think, when their databases get to like 5 and 10 gig, that suddenly, this is the reason the thing is getting slow, Yet yesterday I was talking to one of the guys, I don't know if he's here, but, they have a table currently that's, 11 terabytes and they're adding 50 gig per day and they think that performs quite well, right? I have other clients in North Sydney who do, 10,000 inserts per second 24/7, right? So most people are not in the ballpark of those sorts of numbers, right? So the thing is, if you think SQL Server is slow, then you need to have a very careful look at how you're using it, right? But it's more always design issues when I see this. Clearly, appropriate indexing is usually a low-hanging fruit there, and things like fragmentation. These things are still issues in these environments. But the difference is that in on-premises, scaling the thing means buying more hardware. But in the case of this environment, scaling means architecting for multiple databases and then provisioning more, right? Now, this means a very, very different way of thinking about your database designs. It also means, given the fact you are dealing with latency, that you need to be thinking about asynchronous design patterns in your applications, and which, again, people commonly don't do. Now, is latency really an issue? Well, yes, right? You have to avoid chatty interfaces. To give you an idea there, I was at a site 2 weeks ago where the first screen they brought up, when I did the tracing, it had done 90,000 remote procedure calls before the first screen came up in the app, right? I see a number of people cringing in the room, but like that's how it worked. That happened in about 30 seconds on their site. And this is why I say SQL Server is actually pretty fast, right? That's not a bad effort. But if they had simply pointed the connection string at the Singapore database data center, that same app would have taken 2 weeks to start and bring up the first screen, right? So you just can't point a connection string somewhere else and hope for the best, right? I mean, that's not a plan, right, doing that. So you need to minimize the round trips. You need to pick the appropriate data center. And where possible, you want to co-locate your applications with the data in the data centers. Now, the thing that you're going to perceive is the time it takes from your app to the data center, then from the data center to the database. You've then got the time it takes to execute the query. Then you've got the reverse of these coming back. The difference is that the query execution time used to be the long bit. Most of the time now, that's the short bit, in these environments. And so I did some testing from Bris Vegas a couple of weeks ago. Now, to give you a feel, just on the different data centers, you need to test this and have a look at where the data centers are and try all the data centers, because it depends on where you are and which ISP you're using. So, for example, I know that while here, Southeast Asia, which is in Singapore, was the closest from Brisbane on Telstra the other day, and East Asia, which is the Hong Kong one, was the next closest. But if I went to New Zealand, for example, I know I've tried this in Auckland, and one of the central US ones was the closest, right? And it's simply wherever the major cable routes are and so on and where the fiber's laid, this is going to determine which is the closest. So don't assume that whatever geographically closer is going to be the best. But importantly, that's never going to be anything like your local network, right? So there is a significant difference there. Now, to have a look at that, let me show you this. And so in Management Studio, I've first up, if I just connect to my local server, I just want to show you that the management tree you get is somewhat different when you connect off to one of the Azure servers. So, same tools I can use, but as long as you're on a fairly recent version of it, I might add. And so notice it's a much more simplistic tree. And I've got my database there. Now, if I open a query window and run a query against this, I mean, all that sort of stuff works just the same. Yeah, no surprises here. And also, I mean, all the normal things, like query plans and so on. So if I like say, look, you know, give me the query plan, include that, run this. I mean, I'm going to get exactly the same stuff as I get normally when I'm working on premises. But the difference is where that latency is happening. Notice also, if I try and change to a different database, I get a, you're not going to do that, right? So use isn't supported to switch between databases. Notice they say use another connection to get to the other database. This is something to think about. Now, if I open a query, the thing you want to do is execute a query that takes no time at all, like I've done a, in this I do a select hello, but what you want to do is turn on client statistics so that you can have a look at where that latency is occurring. And so if I turn on client statistics, put in a simple query that's not going to have any execution time, and run this. And then when you look at the statistics, you'll get a breakdown of the query time as opposed to the total execution time. So notice here, I had 1 millisecond of client processing time and 127 milliseconds of complete execution. So typically now, these sort of things are going to dwarf the execution time when you're running. So you don't want to be having simple queries that you're doing in a very chatty way. Now, in terms of tools mentioned here, a lot of the familiar stuff. So the portal is there and lets you manage the servers. And as I said, the query interface in there is getting a lot better as time goes on. That's the database manager tools in there. It isn't really intended to compete with Management Studio, though, right? So it, Management Studio still is a much better tool for doing this sort of work. Management Studio, you need 2008 SP1 or later. Otherwise, what it does in the earlier versions, it just issues commands that don't make sense up at the other end, and you'll sort of see issues when you try and fire it up and connect. It still works, but it's just the experience isn't so great. The other thing they've done is, of course, SQL Server Data Tools, which is the rebranding of Business Intelligence Development Studio plus the database design tools, now has options, of course, where we could be doing local validation, particularly using the new local DB to test things before we push them up anyway. Now, if you look at migrating apps and data, there are scripting options in Management Studio. I'll show you those in a sec. You need to make sure when you do that, that the scripting you're choosing is targeting SQL Azure, or what's now called Windows Azure SQL Database. I'm still trying to work out how to say that nicely. It's kind of like WASD or something. Where reporting's not too bad. WASA sounds almost Australian. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I like that. And so anyway, so we need to check when you're doing the scripting, is there anything it complains about that would be a problem for that? They also, in 2008 R2, introduced data tier applications, which were very limited at the time. They've now had a big degree of work, and the DACPAC format now deals with a lot of data types and things that it couldn't do in 2008 R2. It's certainly worth a look again if you looked at it in an earlier version and decided it wasn't for you. And continuing on the DAC PAC type naming, in 2012 we now have ISPAC, which is the new integration services packages, and we have BACPACs, which are now data tier applications that include data as well as including the schema. Now, typically that's used for reference data and things like that, but it can be reasonable amounts of data you could push off into a DAC pack as well. There is a SQL Azure migration wizard that does a reasonable job, and it's quite cleverly written. There's a show up on Channel 9, the Microsoft site, where they show you through that. Actually, it wasn't Channel 9. It was in... there's a thing called Cloud Cover, is one of the video series. It's up on Channel 9 anyway, but it's called Cloud Cover, and they have the guy who wrote it, and he actually sort of shows you through using that tool. It's quite nice. One of the things that struck me about it is how resilient the thing is. You know, he's built it multi-threaded. He's built it, does lots and lots of checks and retries and stuff. It's very clever the way it's done. Integration services can target this WASD environment, and so can BCP. Do you have to change your apps? Well, most of the T-SQL now works pretty well. As I said, tables have to have a clustered index. The sorts of things that I find really are a problem for a lot of people is if your application assumes, you know, names of users like administrator, you know, and so on, there are some limitations on a couple of reserved words and so on. That sort of thing you need to check out as well. That sort of thing can be an issue. But not all the components are there. So there currently isn't an agent. Now, that may be a showstopper for some people, but it's relatively trivial to implement those things in Azure worker roles or to use the new service bus architecture to implement a lot of that stuff. But that, I'm sure, down the track that will come. Full text is one that is dear to my heart. I wish it was there. But service broker, some of the dependencies. SQL CLR, the system CLR objects are now there. They weren't in earlier versions, but they've added those. So that's the geometry, geography, and hierarchy ID types are now there. But user-defined CLR types are not yet supported. They've also recently added support for MARS, the multiple active result sets, and, as I said, the spatial data types have gone in there. I'll just quickly show you the scripting. And so in this case, off a database, and so I picked one that could potentially work with this, then on tasks, so it's not script database, it's tasks generate scripts is the one you need to go into. If you do the other one, you just get the database structure. And so here I've decided to just script a particular table, so I've grabbed just product. Now the trick is the advanced tab. And if you look in here, a couple of things. First up, you can script for specific versions now. And so I can target SQL 2012, but you can also script for an instance type. And so there's a SQL Azure instance. And finally, do I want the schema or the schema and the data or just the data and so on? These are now options that you can set within the scripting, and that'll sort of generate a SQL script for you. All right. Now, what if other apps don't play fair on my server? Well, it's not really your server, for a start. But it's important to understand it's not intended for really high resource requirement apps. So if you have one app that needs to absolutely hammer a server, you're probably talking about the wrong sort of app, right, in that case. You have shared resources. So TempDB, worker threads, disk, network, all these things are shared resources. And so the way it balances, it has a load balancer that periodically sort of moves along and does the things across the servers to make sure that they're all getting a reasonable share. It swaps or moves workloads. Now, move is a kind of an interesting concept. But what it'll do is it can pick your database up and move it to a different server while it's in use without even dropping a connection, you know, which is nice, because that's the connection's maintained by the front end. Now, part of the reason they do this might not be obvious, but two-thirds of the cost of running the data center is power. And cooling is the number one thing that takes power. So unlike your data centers or whatever, they're constantly moving applications to the coolest part of the data center to keep the overall temperature down, which is kind of bizarre that we're thinking that way, but this is the sort of things they're having to deal with. In addition, they have a reactive load balancer that says, if there's a short-term issue, we need to fix it. Now, fix it usually could mean throttling, but these are short-term issues. So what's throttling? The idea is that they have to make everybody play fair. And so there's two types of throttle. There's a soft throttle and a hard throttle. Soft throttle is where they look at the one database that's causing an issue and they stop it doing things briefly. A hard throttle is where the whole machine is becoming a problem. They stop all of the databases on that machine or start swapping things out. Now, there is a list, and way too small to sort of go through here, but just want to mention there's like a breakdown of the sorts of things. This is in MSDN, and it'll tell you the things that can cause this, right? And so, for example, there are a limit of 512 worker threads per machine. If they get to 410, then they go, we have to do something here. You know, they start sort of worrying about it. All these things are quite proactive in the way they deal with them. The sort of things that can cause you issues, if you start writing more than 2 gigabytes per transaction. Now, hopefully that doesn't sound like a really well-designed transaction, but the thing is, if you do that, these are the sorts of things that are going to cause you to have an issue, right? And so how do I avoid it? You need to make sure your database code runs properly. You need to make sure that your indexes and stuff work properly. But then start monitoring, if you do get these, what is it that's causing this, right? Now, there are DMVs, or things like exec query stats will sort of give you details of which queries are having problems and so on. But if you're getting errors back, there are specific errors related to throttling. You need to monitor those and also have retry logic. But there's an article also in MSDN that says, start here, and this is how you work out what the deal is. And so first up, it's what's the throttling mode, and then based on the mode, what are the reasons I'm getting throttled. Now, a nice thing is that this is improving. You should see throttling disappearing over time. They're getting better and better at proactively dealing with this stuff all the time. So for example, they implemented Resource Governor widely in about late last year. And so since then, we've not seen CPU throttling happening, right? And so on. So this is an improving story all the time. So will your app stay connected? No. All right. So if you build your app on the assumption that I connect, I hold a connection and hope for the best, right? This is not a plan, right, for dealing with these sort of environments. But I see people do this in on-premises applications, and it's not a plan there either, right? So if I see so many organizations I go into where people have paid a fortune for high-end, high-availability gear, and yet the minute the servers fail over, like they're designed to do, you know, every app in the building breaks, you know, sorry, the devs just didn't do their work, right? It's, you know, can you deal with the idea that the server disappears for 30 seconds maybe? Yes, you could, right? I mean, if you'd thought about that up front. I mean, and so instead of a plan that says start a transaction, do the work and hope for the best and commit, you need to have logic that's much more like, while we haven't committed this chunk of work, let's try and slip it in, right? And if I get back, even on premises, if I get back something like a deadlock occurred, then I need to kind of back off and probably have another go, right? That sort of thing. I can deal with that in code. Now, if I get back a primary key violation, okay, fair cop. You know, you're probably going to have to go bang. But there are lots of scenarios that you could make it fairly invisible to the users that something's happened. So you should design, though, with an assumption of failure, and then be pleasantly surprised. Now, code examples. In Entlib, that is there. So a number of people do use Entlib. It's not something I use a lot myself, but It's available out of NuGet, and it's been significantly updated. In particular, they've got a transient fault application handling block, and that exposes a reliable SQL connection object, and it has a whole lot of the retry logic and stuff built in. What the connection has is it has the underlying connection plus a retry policy, and the policy is the count, or it can be a count plus wait some time, you know, number of retries and so on. As well as execute no query, they also have, or non-query it should be, there's also execute non-query with retry. They've added a method there that does that. The retrying event is exposed out of the connection, so you can pick up the fact that that's occurring. And finally, if you're coding with link, because you don't get to fiddle with that stuff under the covers, they've also added an execute action method that you can use to wrap your link code, and then it runs it in that sort of retried state. Now, backup and restore is an interesting one. And so there isn't the equivalent of what would you think of as just let me do a database backup. Now, again, I could see that potentially changing down the track, but the nice thing they've added in recent times is copy database. And I'll show you an example of this in a second, but it allows me to say create a database as a copy of another database. Now, the wickedly cool thing about this is it doesn't even have to be on the same server or the same data center. So what that means is I can have a database and I can say create a copy of that in Northern Europe. You know what I mean? And suddenly there are now three replicas of your data, you know, sitting in Northern Europe, you know, where a minute ago there were only copies in Singapore. Now, how would you do that? You know, normally, like, I mean, that's insanely cool. And so the idea here, too, is it's a transactionally consistent copy. And so you do have control over how many copies of this stuff is around. In addition, there is an import and export wizard that deals with backpacks. And that works kind of fine, but it's not a transactionally consistent state. It's kind of copying the tables and whatever the data is in the tables at the time. So the way you get a transactionally consistent backpack is to do a copy of the database to a new database and then export it to a DACPack, right? Because that way you know the other one's not being used. Now, could I just pick up my database scripts and point them there? Well, yeah, but, and again, I see people say this all the time, but don't do that with data, you know. Give you an example here. I had a script that was just 21 meg database, not very big. I pointed that at my local server on my notebook. It took 55 seconds. I pointed it at an Azure data center. It took 1 hour 52, right? That same script. All an issue with latency because it was all sort of separate statements in the script. However, I exported to a backpack locally. That took 13 seconds. Oh, sorry, exported from the local server to Azure storage took 13 seconds, and importing it took 52. Right? So the thing you've got to think about is that it isn't necessarily the same way you'll do things. There are solutions, but you need to start to get across what they are. So let me show you that. So they've made the UI. There's a thing here that's a little confusing. So notice on tasks there's extract data to your application. Now, that was there in the previous version and creates a DAC pack. But curiously, as well as extract, there's export data to your application. And so forgiven if the distinction is not immediately obvious. But it generates a backpack. Now, I can connect directly to my Azure storage account and then pick the folder that I want to drop it into, and so on. And literally, that'll just a local file that'll create it in first, and that just creates it, and then just pushes it straight up into Azure storage. Now, I'd already done one of those, but on the server, I can say import, and then give login credentials, say what the new database name is that I want, and the edition, and then I have to give it the URL that covers where that backpack is in Azure storage. So that's my address for that. And the other thing is they need a key. Now there's two types of key. There's a storage access key, which is the one I've used here, And there's also a shared access key. I'll mention that one in a minute. And so with the normal access key, so that what that does is it then queues this as a job to be done in the background. So it's sort of the request has been submitted. And then what we'll find is that over time, that database will appear. Now, the other thing I've done here is to show you a copy. If I open has to be to the master database, if I open a query window, then I can execute just copy or create database, sorry, create database PPK as copy of, and then another database. And again, this is going to return immediately, but then shortly after the database will appear there, because they're effectively doing the equivalent of like a backup and restore under the covers. If we look back in the portal, and I've got the original one there, I've got the PPK one there now, and you'd find that if I refresh this after a little while, then the indexing ones now appear there, the one that's imported from the backpack. And so these are the options that you have. You also can check the status of those import requests, and so again, login credentials here. And this shows you the status of the jobs that are on the go, plus ones that have been run in recent times. And brings up, and you can see the sort of imports that I've done and the jobs for those. Now, the other thing I mentioned there was that there are shared access keys. And the idea here is that while you have a URL and a key that you need to be able to get access to objects inside Azure Storage, sometimes you want to give somebody temporary access. And so there's the ability to generate a key with a time horizon. So I can give somebody a key that says, this is good for an hour. Right? And then the URL does not work after that, and so on. So you can generate those types of keys as well. All right. Now, federations is an interesting one because, as I said, we're scaling out rather than scaling up. This is allowing us to sort of simplify how you might do multi-tenancy, because sharding a database and breaking it into pieces is tough work. And so they've got some of the code for this already there in federations. And at the moment, it's designed for allowing it to grow. But for an elastic thing, you also need to be able to bring it back again, right? And so that bit isn't there yet. So the merge part, the syntax is there, but it doesn't do it yet, right? So, but that is coming. And so the idea is that in a table, I pick a column that I'm going to distribute the values on, has to be int, begint, var, binary, or good. And then I have different types of tables. So I create a federated table, and this is the one that is the reason I'm doing this in the first place. So it typically is going to be something with maybe a transaction number or something, and we're going to spread it over a lot of data. Or it's a client number. Maybe I've got a whole lot of clients in who have their own accounting system in my one database or something. The idea is that I can say, look, you know, here's the client ID. This is what I'm going to distribute it over. And I could then decide which clients are in which database. You've also got reference tables. And so when you create a federation member or do a split, the reference tables are cloned across automatically to the other databases, typically small lookup data. And you can also have tables that live in the root of the federation as well, but that's more about metadata. And so the idea is they have a use federation statement. So I said you can't use, but you can use federation. Right? And so the idea here is I can use that to determine which are the servers that I'm going to go off and connect to. Let me show you this. And so I've got SQL script here running against a database I'm creating a database called FedTest. And so notice that there isn't a GUI there at the moment, so it opens a template. But mind you, create database is pretty simple. So I'm just going to replace the name of that with FedTest. That has to be executed against master. And that'll create the database. Now, that's given me what's going to be the root of my federation. Then what I'm doing is connecting this script to that database. And the first thing I do is say, look, I want to create a federation called Client, and I'm going to distribute database items based on what I've called a client distribution. The first thing I do is connect to one of the federation members, so it's created the root, and it creates one member. And so I say, use federation. That says, connect me to the federation member that currently covers client zero. We'll see how this gets used. I'm then creating a table, which is like a lookup table. And in that one, I've got, as in this case, it's just business categories, and insert a couple of those. But the important query is the one underneath it. And so this is where I'm creating my customers. And then what I'm saying, note the clause at the end where it says federated on the client distribution, which is based on the column client ID. And so this is the next statement. So this is the table is the one that I'm federating across. Now what that'll do first up is I just have one federation member that has everybody in it. And so if you look at sys federation member distributions, this sort of shows, and you see that the range low is the biggest negative number, and range high is null. So it's basically got all of the things into one federation. What we then do is say use federation root with reset and alter its split at 500. And what that does is then creates new federation members. In fact, it creates two new members, and it's going to migrate all the data to those two members. In the meantime, it still happily allows you to transact against the one that you're working on, which is a neat trick. So this isn't something that requires it to stop. And then after some delay, if we keep looking at this, you'll notice that eventually there are now two members and they're split at the value 500. So there's now two databases they've created and they've removed the previous one. So the idea now is I can say, I want to use the member that holds details for client 2, and I've said filtering is off, and if I look, that'll show me all the customers that are on that particular federation member. So that's the sort of filtering. Now, if I do the filtering on, what it says is only show me the stuff for client 2. And so this is a neat trick. So the idea is that I'm basically saying, here's my tenant. I'm interested in programming against tenant 2. If I turn filtering on, then every command I execute is done in the context of just client 2 without me changing the rest of the code. So it's kind of like they've automatically shoved in, you know, the client ID in the front of every query that you run. Whereas if you say filtering off, which you mostly wouldn't, it's showing you everything that's on that particular machine, on that particular database. Now, one of the questions comes up. People say, well, can I run a query that runs right across all the different databases? And the answer is no, right? They don't have an option for that yet. It'll appear, but my contention is that's the wrong question, right? If I'm scaling out by getting a whole lot of databases to play together, the last thing I want to be doing is issuing queries that go out and hit every database, right? What you want to be doing is having parallel queries, you know, from the client perspective, that hits each database individually. You know, this is how you get performance. You know, not by, you know, chaining the whole thing to go off and hit a whole lot of databases. That's not the thinking for trying to scale this up. All right. Look, more info on federations. Go and see AZR 432. Chris Auld's doing Friday in here 9:45. Now, another one is DataSync. I just want to mention where this one's sitting. As I said, it's in preview. But the idea with this, it's based on the Sync framework. And what they're trying to do is automate the idea that you might want to keep a bunch of databases in sync. Now, it's got two ways of doing this. It can do, you set up a sync hub, which is an Azure database, and you set a sync group around it. You then can add additional databases. So there could be additional Azure databases, in which case that's the end of the work. It's very, very easy to do. Alternately, if you're syncing with an on-premises SQL Server, then what you have is they have a Windows service that you install that plays the game in terms of the sync. So they don't assume that you have agent and stuff like that locally. Now, compatibility, there are some issues with this. As said, for example, Spatial is dear to my heart, but that one's not yet supported in DataSync. It is based on change tracking, so it's not a transactional thing. So it's trying to track individual changes to tables. And it is data only, so it's not modifying the code and so on. It's not pushing that around. But it does end up doing it via in local SQL databases via triggers on tables and so on. You need to make sure that your apps are comfy with the triggers and so on with that. But this has become a very interesting option. I have a client that has, say, 80 stores, and they need to endlessly centralize data for reporting purposes. It becomes very interesting now. I can just create an Azure database that has the data I want to hold there. I can just create one more local database on that server that collects all the stuff I'm interested in, and then I just sync that up to the one in the cloud. And this has become a very, very simple way of doing this compared to all the options we've used in the past. And so, if you have an on-premises one, then what you're going to have is basically an agent service, but it's not SQL Server Agent, it's another Windows service. So that means also it works with SQL Express as well. It doesn't have agent. If you're doing client-to-client, this is going to be two hops, right? So we have different sync groups set up in one that I've been playing with, and so the idea is from the head office, they can broadcast stuff out, or they can collect things from the stores and bring it back in, so different sync groups. Typical provisioning is you deploy the database to the hub and the clients, you configure a sync group saying what are the data sets that are going to get moved around and how are they filtered. You pick a schedule that says how often does this happen, and a conflict resolution policy. You install the agent on the on-premises servers, and then you add all the clients to the topology, and then you deploy the topology. I'll quickly show you the interface for that. And so in here with these subscriptions, I've got a server set up for doing data sync. So if I look at that one, again, in the subscriptions, I've got particular servers set up under that. So open up the ASDEM one. And so I've called that Southeast Asia. It's not a specific name. And then within that, the idea is you can start to set up sync groups. The thing I like with this is it walks you through the process of doing it. And so notice here the middle option says sync between on-premises and Windows Azure. And once you go into that, it sort of literally leads you step by step through what's required. So what do you want to call the sync group? And then step to the next step. And then it's going to be, you know, which SQL server, and maybe I'm adding one that an on-premises one. And then basically it's saying, look, is this one that we've worked with before, or are you adding this in? Notice the sync direction is bi-directional, or you can set it in either direction. Next. And then it's got options to go in and install the agent, and then again I go off and configure the agent. The other sort of stuff that's happening in here, I've shown off to the right here, which I'll scroll across, but you can set the schedule on which this happens. And so in there, that's enabled currently. So the default is every 30 minutes, but that can be dragged down significantly. And the conflict resolution at the moment is hub wins or client wins. That's a simple choice. That's it. But I think it has promise, this one. As I said, the agent, even though it's in preview, it's been through about 7 previews at the moment, so it's becoming quite mature. And look, the final one is reporting. And so this one's interesting. The idea is that we're have our data sitting in SQL Azure, and then it's or Windows Azure SQL database, and it'd be nice instead of dragging it all down to do reporting that we could actually do the reporting up there instead. And so again, this is delivered as a service. We have an endpoint, which is just the normal web service endpoints that you have with SQL reporting. They've implemented it as a worker role inside Azure, so that's how it actually works, and they've got a sticky gateway so that when you keep hitting it, you keep getting the same one. The target for this is embedded reporting inside web apps. That's what it's about. And the provisioning is nice, because literally you can provision a reporting server in a couple of minutes, and so, which is so very different to doing projects on in-house. you know, clearly. And the idea, though, is that you typically want to co-locate the reporting server with the data that it's working with. Now, differences. So it's like a first pass at this one. So it is the same report designer, the same RDL, the same deployment mechanisms. You just pointed at it. If you look at the data sources you configure in reporting services, there is a SQL Azure data source type. Right? So there's a specific one in the list for doing that. The web services are the same. The URL access is the same. The report viewer control that was updated in 2010 works absolutely fine here. Item level permissions are assignable as well. But the nice thing is you also pick up the built-in high availability that you don't normally have for reporting servers, and you get these sort of scale-out options. Now, the things that are different, it is SQL authentication only right now. Okay, so this works okay, though, in most sites I've seen where you're embedding this inside an app, because people often end up using fixed credentials out of the app anyway. It is SSL only, and it can only report on Azure data sources. But the other things, it doesn't currently support schedules or subscriptions or report builder, code extensions internally, and external images. Let me show you this. So again, reporting is one of the options I've got in place. And I've got one report server provisioned. Notice it's a different name to my SQL one. I've provisioned that in Southeast Asia, so that's in the Singapore data center. Up the top, it's given me the web service URL, which is the normal port 443 style URL for doing that. I've got the folders, I've got my data sources and PPK reports, and these are folders and things exactly the same as you'd have in reporting services. In fact, all I did was create those things and deploy them directly from SQL Server data tools. In the folder, I've got a Cinema Contacts report. If I click on that, you can open it up in here. It's going to open up another window and then get you to re-authenticate if I do that. But anyway, the main thing is you'll see that you could do this, and in here it's going to show me this as using the same report viewer control. So my report's sitting there. I mean, I get the same sort of export options and things. I mean, basically, it is the same control. As I said, the main thing is it's working just directly with the data that we have sitting in SQL Azure instead. So, look, finally, I think the future in this stuff is logical design and so on. In the future, I just don't imagine you're going to be spending more of your time focusing on low-level details of how things work. It's interesting, it's geeky, but it's probably not what you're going to be doing for a living, you know, down the track. And it's important, I think, to start getting much more involved in the sort of logical design aspects. Federations, I think, are interesting for scaling out. As I said, go and see Chris on Friday. Data Sync, I think, has good potential for building some very interesting applications. And it's nice that the reporting is now available. I can only imagine other BI tools will start to be available as well. And this allows you to do rapid work on the data that's already up there. So look, this stuff is ready for business now and increasingly is being used that way. But the thing you really need to spend time thinking about is the sort of opportunities you can now do that you just couldn't do before, right? That's the key thing. And so look, there is an option here. Please stick in some eval details and win yourself a mouse. And there's resources up on Channel 9, and all these sessions are going to go up on there. You get the chance to win a helicopter ride, which looks kind of cool. I think if we did that, I'd be going by myself. And anyway, so look, thanks very much for that. And what I'd ask you also, if you do happen to, because I happen to create videos, if you do want a copy of those, just pop me an email and I'll give you a link where you can grab those. So I thank you so much for being here early in the morning and for listening. I'll be downstairs at 11 o'clock in the speaker lounge, and then most of the rest of the day probably up on the first floor around the table. So if you've got anything, just come and pop by and say hi. Thanks, folks.